We will now then have very much pleasure in calling upon our brother Roger Lewis of Christchurch Suburban Ecclesia in New Zealand to begin our studies around the life of Phineas to the title, The House of Levi and the Tragedy of Corruption. Thanks, Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman. Firstly, before the tape starts, can everybody hear me come
like a magnet towards the microphone?
I really wanted to stand back a little bit. Can everyone hear me comfortably from this distance, yes or no? No problem over there? Okay. Everyone fine back there? Raise your hand at the back if you can hear. Splendid. Splendid. All right. Well, that's good. In that case, I shall remain aloof from the microphone. You can now begin the tape. Up till now, we have not begun. So, as our chairman has said, we start then this afternoon our studies on the life of Phineas. And we start with this study on the house of Levi and the tragedy of corruption that took place in that particular house and in that particular tribe. You know, I'd like to start, brothers and sisters and young people, by saying something that's impressed me in the divine record over the last few years, perhaps in particular, and that's this, that the Bible is not history. The Bible is selective history. And between those two things, there's actually a very large difference, isn't there? You know, in the life of Abraham, we have an enormous sequence of chapters in the book of Genesis that focus on the life of this faithful man, and yet, as we all know, the life of Abraham is drawn from but 25 years of 175 that he lived. You see, almost as if we're being told that whatever the other 150 years of his life were about, that these 25 were typical years. They were representative of the man. The Bible doesn't record everything about Abraham. It doesn't need to. You know, that Lydia, as a woman, only occurs in three verses in the divine record in the New Testament. And yet, I believe that that woman stamped upon her home ecclesia a peculiar grace and a particular gracious spirit of hospitality that made that ecclesia unique. She's only mentioned in three verses. Do you know that Peter gives a speech in Acts chapter 3 that clearly takes less than 3 minutes to read, and yet we know from the divine record must have taken over 3 hours to deliver. So we obviously only have but a fragment, you see, of the story, and yet the fragment that we're given is enough for us to know what God would have us to know. Isn't that true? The Bible, you see, is not history, it's selective history. It is the unfolding of the divine purpose. And therefore what is here is important for us to know. Now, in the case of Phineas, we only have a few scattered fragments in his life. In fact, any of you that have done any background study towards this weekend will know that the emphasis should be on the fact that there is a few scattered fragments of his life. And yet in reading those fragments, we understand the whole scroll of his life. That's obviously what God would intend us to do. That the few episodes that we have are obviously intended to give us the spirit of the man. And that's what we're going to try and do, God willing, in these studies. We're going to try and paint the portrait of this man as the Spirit has engraved him in the Holy Writ. He's a remarkable man, the more we get into the divine record. He's a man that walks tall in the narrative. He looms larger than you might first imagine. This is the man where the remarkable story of his birth is recorded in the book of Exodus. The greatest event that shaped his life is found in the book of Leviticus. His most famous exploit in Israel is to be found in the book of Numbers. The most interesting negotiation of his life is found in the book of Joshua. The darkest moment of his career is found in the book of Judges. His greatest accomplishments are sung in the book of Psalms, and his final eulogy is given in the prophecy of Malachi. Oh, yes, he looms large in the record, does this man, larger than we might first imagine. He will cast a shadow, brothers and sisters, reaching finally into the New Testament record itself. And I've wrestled with this man for 12 months. For 12 months I agonized over whether this man was right or wrong, good or bad, wise or unwise. Where does Phineas stand in all that he does and that all that he says? And at the end of those wrestlings, I think, brothers and sisters, that he appears in the divine record as a man where, as with so many men and women in the Bible, we need to understand them from the perspective of their own life circumstances and their own life's work. And I think there's one great characteristic, you see, of Phineas that gives us the perspective by which we must come to understand his life. Now, for those of you that have access to the sheets, which I do hope you all have, I'm going to take you then through one of these particular overheads now. In fact, we might look at the first two now. Overheads 1A and 1B. So firstly, the question of the timeline of Phineas. Now, these times are estimates only, but I think they're pretty close, you see. I'm going to say later on in the divine record here that I believe that Phineas was born in the land of Egypt. That before the Exodus began, Phineas was already to be counted as part of the tribe of Levi. In fact, I think I've suggested he was possibly about 10 by the time the record of the Exodus occurs, which means that he was no older than about 11 or 12 at the time of the tragedy of Nadab and Abihu, which we're going to look at later. And furthermore, I believe that the rebellion of Korah, Dathan and Abiram probably happened hard on the heels of that previous episode, at about the age of 13. He was still a young man, a very young man, when these two things occurred, these two twin tragedies occurred in the house and in the tribe of Phineas. I'm going to suggest that at the time of Numbers 25, which is probably the one thing that we all remember about Phineas, isn't it? The moment of the javelin, the story of the javelin. He was a man of about 50. By the time that episode occurred. When we come to the controversy over the matter of the altar in Joshua 22, I believe he was about 60 years of age. The story of the destruction of Benjamin, which we're going to look at in the record of Judges, I think he was about 90 years of age. And he died at about 100 years of age, as the record says there. That's an estimate based on some calculations from Josephus and other writings about the length of his priesthood. And here's the key word that characterizes his life in the next overhead. It's the word zeal, you see. You see, what's the outstanding characteristic of Abraham? Well, it's faith. What's the outstanding characteristic of David? What would you say for David, by the way? The one great outstanding characteristic of David.
Mercy.
Mercy, indeed. What about Hezekiah?
Trust.
And here, Phineas. The one great characteristic, you see, that marks all that Phineas shall ever do and ever say is the word zeal. He was a zealous man. And I think it's a great lesson that comes out of that, you see, because, you see, this is a characteristic of God himself. God himself is a zealous God. The Bible tells us that God's name is the Zealous One. And therefore, this is a characteristic of the Father himself. This is not the zeal of uncontrolled passion, but it is the zeal of intense love and intense desire to do that which is right in the sight of God. We've got a definition there of zeal from the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. And we might just read the middle paragraph there, which says, God's jealousy, when offended, issued in just retribution, but when stirred by his grace, it resulted in eternal love. God expects man to return his love. Love, however, is not simply an emotion. It is a structured relationship. To love God is to obey him. And so the word zeal, kana, is used to denote a passionate, consuming zeal focused on God that results in the doing of his will and the maintaining of his honor in the face of the ungodly acts of men. And in fact, the definition goes on to say that Phineas is a particular example of this zeal. Now, I want you to notice the last paragraph. The godly, especially Messiah, are consumed, therefore, by an ardor to exalt God by maintaining purity of worship, that's principle, and purity of obedience, that's practice. And the reason why I've stressed those two words is because they're going to become the two great themes, or two of the great words in the life of Phineas. Purity of principle and purity of practice. Phineas would be a man zealous for those things throughout his life. And God willing, in our introductory study this afternoon, we hope to find out why it was that he was so passionate about the purity and the holiness of the truth. What brought him to that? Well, let's come and have a look at Exodus chapter 6, shall we, in terms of this remarkable genealogy that introduces Phineas to us for the first time in the divine record. By the way, before I carry on, one thing that I've said over many years, and I still believe this is true, in fact it's a quotation from another person anyway, and that's that good Bible study is based on good Bible reading, isn't it? But it's something more than that. It's also based on good questions, isn't it? Good Bible questions, I think, are a key, you see, to good Bible study. And so what we've done in the course of these studies, and God willing, you shall receive a sheet, no more, no less, at the start of each study. And in that will be four questions about the key narrative that we're going to look at that time. Because it's in the answering of these questions that our understanding grows. And by the way, it's in the asking of the questions that we understand how little we understand. Now you see, divine genealogies are generally considered to be dry things, aren't they? The genealogies of the Bible, what terribly boring things they are. But you see, they're really quite exciting once we start to ask questions. So you see, overhead 1D here, here's four questions then on the genealogy of Exodus 6, just to get us going. We're told there, question one, why does the genealogy of the fathers' houses stop after only three tribes? Because, you see, it says in verse 14, these be the heads of their fathers' houses, the sons of Reuben. Verse 15, the sons of Simeon. Verse 16, the sons of Levi. And then the genealogy stops concerning the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel. Now, why would that be? And the second question is, do you think there's any significance in the fact that this genealogy of Levi starts in verse 16 with Levi himself and ends with Phineas in verse 25? Did you notice that that's where the genealogy stops? Phineas, verse 25. Any significance in that, do you think? And here's the third question. Oh, this is an interesting one. Now, you see verse 20. It says, Amram took him Jochebed, his father's sister, to wife. Now, do you know who that is? That's the great-grandfather and the great-grandmother of Phineas. His great-grandfather and his great-grandmother, Amram and Jochebed, verse 20. And then in verse 23 it says, Aaron took him Elisheba, daughter of Amminadab, sister of Nahashon, to wife. So this is his grandfather and his grandmother. Both mentioned, you see, in the divine record. Question is, of course, verse 25, why isn't his mother mentioned? His great-grandmother's mentioned in verse 20. His grandmother's mentioned in verse 23. Why is his mother not mentioned, verse 25? Any thoughts on that? And here's the last question. It relates to verse 25. But to understand it, we need to read verse 23. It says, Aaron took him Elisheba, daughter of Amminadab, the sister of Nahashon, to wife, and she bare him. Now, so here are the sons of Aaron. Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, Ithamar. And then verse 25 says, and Eleazar, Aaron's sons, or Aaron's son, took him one of the daughters of Putiel to wife. But Eleazar is the third son of Aaron in verse 23. Why does the record in verse 25 jump over Nadab and Abihu and go straight to the third son? And lest, by the way, you think you already know the answer to that question, don't be too sure. So, you see, there's something about genealogies, like any other part of the divine record, it'll only come alive when we start to actually give time and attention to what it's all about by asking questions. You see, good questions are a very important part of good Bible study. Well, here's the answer to those questions then. The first question was, why does the genealogy stop after only three tribes? And the reason for that, brothers and sisters and young people, is simply this, that the genealogy of Exodus 6 is not a summary of the 12 tribes. It's not even a genealogy of three tribes. It's a genealogy of only two men. The genealogy of Exodus 6 is the genealogy of only two men. And they are called, in verse 13, Moses and Aaron. And this genealogy is the story of these two men who were going to be the redeemers and the deliverers of the nation. You see that? Verse 13, Yahweh spake unto Moses and Aaron. Verse 20, Amram took him Jochebed, his father's sister, to wife, and she bare him Aaron and Moses. Verse 26, these are that Aaron and Moses. End of verse 27, these are that Moses and Aaron. This is only the genealogy of two men. The two men who would lead the nation out of Egypt and towards the promised land. And therefore, the only reason that Reuben is mentioned in verse 14 and Simeon is mentioned in verse 15 is to give the chronological setting to the tribe of Levi, which comes third, of course, in verse 16, so that the genealogy of Moses and Aaron can be introduced. And did you notice this? You see how there's a change there? Verse 13, Moses and Aaron becomes, in verse 20, Aaron and Moses. Verse 26, Aaron and Moses. Verse 27, Moses and Aaron. You notice that? You see how each man is mentioned twice, first in the record, and so in a sense that is true also, isn't it? Because you see, Aaron was first in the matter of the genealogy and therefore becomes the priestly leader, and Moses was the first in strength of character and therefore becomes the civil leader of these two who would lead the nation to safety and to redemption. Now, notice this also, that the genealogy begins with Levi, verse 16, and ends with Phinehas, verse 25. But you see, I think that this genealogy is the record of Levi's house before they were called out of Egypt. You see, verse 13, Yahweh spake unto Moses and unto Aaron and gave them a charge unto the children of Israel, unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. So that's the story here, that they're going to bring them out of the land of Egypt. These be the heads of the fathers' houses. And then you see verse 25, at the end of the verse, it says, these are the heads of the fathers of the Levites, these are that Aaron and Moses, to whom Yahweh said, bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies. These are they which spake to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt. So, you see, I think this is the genealogy of Levi before the Exodus occurred. And that what we're being told, therefore, in this record, is that included in that genealogy before the Exodus took place, Phinehas, verse 25, is reckoned into the house of Levi. He was born there. He was already alive before they left Egypt. "Out of Egypt have I called my son," would be something that Phineas would share in common with the Messiah who was to come. And what about the mention of the great-grandmother and the grandmother, but not the mother? Well, I think probably the answer to that little puzzle lies, you see, in the meaning of the names, because Amram and Jochebed in verse 20 mean respectively the kindred of the highest, whose glory is Yahweh. That was the name of his great-grandparents. The kindred of the highest, whose glory is Yahweh. And the name of his grandparents, together, combined, was the enlightener of the power of the oath. But when we come to Phineas's father, verse 25, his name is Eliezer. But you see, it doesn't say the name of the woman he married. In fact, it mentions, funnily enough, his father-in-law. Mentions his father-in-law's name. Now, why would it mention Eliezer's father-in-law rather than the name of the woman he was to marry? Now, I think the only reason I could come up with was, well, because the name of the father-in-law is more significant. And you know what Putiel means? It's the only place it's used in the divine record. Putiel means afflicted of God. Now ask yourself this question then. Who was at this time afflicted of God? And isn't that Genesis 15 and verse 13? "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Was it not Israel in Egypt who were afflicted at that very time? Isn't this Exodus 6 verse 9? Moses spake so unto the children of Israel, but they hearkened not unto Moses for anguish of spirit and for cruel bondage. But you see, this man whose name was the afflicted of God, his daughter was to marry Eliezer. And Eliezer means ale will succor. And from the birth of this couple came a boy who was indeed, in a sense, to be a saviour of the nation from the affliction that still lay upon them, because Phineas was going to be a famous man in the record of both this tribe and in the history of the nation itself. And so Israel, who were afflicted at this very time, would be succored with the deliverance wrought not just by Moses and Aaron, but by this man Phineas, who first appears in the divine record in Exodus chapter 6. Now, the other question we had, remember, was verse 25. Why does the record skip over Nadab and Abihu and go straight to Eliezer, the third son of Aaron? Why does it ignore Nadab and Abihu? And you see, I think what most people say is this. They say, oh, well, you see, they're being overlooked in anticipation of the disaster of Leviticus 10. Because we know, don't we, that Nadab and Abihu are going to forfeit their lives in the tragedy of Leviticus 10. We're going to look at it later on in this particular study. At the very time of the consecration of the Aaronic priesthood, Nadab and Abihu were to die. And given the circumstances of their folly, of their sin, and of their wickedness, there was every reason to omit them from the genealogy of Exodus 6 and to introduce Eliezer instead as the rightful successor to the Aaronic privilege. So do you think that's right? Is that the answer then to Exodus chapter 6 verse 25 as to why Nadab and Abihu are ignored? The answer is no, I don't think so. If Nadab and Abihu had died, would not the genealogy simply pass to their sons? Why would the genealogy move entirely to the third son, Eliezer, and to his offspring? If something happened to Nadab and Abihu, wouldn't the genealogy of the priestly line simply move to their offspring and carry on? And you see, that's where the real tragedy of Exodus 6 verse 25 is to be found, isn't it? Because, well, come and have a look at Numbers chapter 3, because here's the real answer, isn't it? Here's the real reason why Nadab and Abihu are not mentioned in the genealogy of Exodus chapter 6. Numbers 3, verse 1. These also are the generations of Aaron and Moses in the day that Yahweh spake with Moses and Mount Sinai. And these are the names of the sons of Aaron, Nadab and the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the priests which were anointed, whom he consecrated to minister in the priest's office. And Nadab and Abihu died before Yahweh when they offered strange fire before Yahweh in the wilderness of Sinai, and here it is, and they had no children. And Eleazar and Ithamar ministered in the priest's office in the sight of Aaron their father. And the reason, brothers and sisters, why Nadab and Abihu are not mentioned in the genealogy of Exodus chapter 6 is because they had no genealogy. They had no offspring for the line to carry on. And the great tragedy of their death in Leviticus 10 was that their very line was extinguished in the suddenness and in the drama of the destruction that overtook them on that occasion, as we shall shortly see. And therefore the record moves to Eleazar, the third son in Exodus chapter 6, because there was no one else to report on. He's the only one left. Although he's the third son of Aaron, he becomes the next in line. Now, you see, there's something very interesting about that, because there's something more than meets the eye with this genealogy, you see, of Exodus chapter 6 and verse 25, when it says that Aaron married and brought forth Phinehas. I want you to take a note of a certain Bible passage. You know that we're told that when Aaron, their father, the father of Nadab and the father of Abihu and the father of Eleazar and the father of Ithamar, when Aaron their father was debating with Pharaoh, we're told in Exodus chapter 7 verse 7 that he was 83. He was 83 years of age. And therefore his sons would have been already in their early 40s and well able to be married and to have children. In fact, we're told in Genesis chapter 25 and verse 20 that Jacob was married at 40. In Genesis 26 and verse 34, Esau was married at 40. We know from the record of Acts chapter 7 verses 23 and 29 that at some stage after the age of 40, Moses was married. 40 was a good time to get married in those days. And yet something happens in this family, so that by the time Nadab and Abihu die, they are already in their 40s and they've never married, or they've never produced children. And yet their younger brother Eleazar has not only married, but before they've left Egypt, he's already fathered a son. And with the tragedy of the death of Nadab and Abihu, that boy Phinehas would spring into the breach and become the greatest exemplar of his house. There was destiny and providence in this from the very beginning. You see, I think we're being told in Exodus chapter 6, really this, verse 16 and verse 25, this is the sum total, you see, of the record of the house of Levi. These are the names of the sons of Levi, and it begins with Levi himself, and it goes through the names, and finally, verse 25, it says, Phinehas, and the genealogy of Levi stops. And I think we're being told that if you want to learn about the house of Levi, you reach the pinnacle of the house of Levi when you reach this man. You need go no further. You want to see the spirit of this tribe? Then it stops at Phinehas. And he's already there before they leave Egypt. Born of Eleazar, and yet his older brothers haven't managed to raise a child between them. I think the hand of providence was in this story right from the beginning, and he was to become the greatest exemplar of Levi's house. Now, let me just show you that in terms of the work of this man. You see, when we read about Phinehas, it's clear that his character was more decisive, his personality was more forceful than either Eleazar, his father, or Aaron, his grandfather. Now, I want to show you something interesting in these next two overheads, which are 1F and 1G.
which are entitled Phineas, the Hero of the House of Levi. Do you know, there's something interesting here, that at the beginning of the wilderness wanderings, there is a story of rebellion and corruption. And at the end of the wilderness wanderings, there is another story of rebellion and corruption. And there are strange similarities between the two records. The first episode, which is Exodus chapter 32, occurs in the first 6 months of the wilderness wanderings. And the last rebellion, which is Numbers 25, occurs in the last 6 months of the wilderness wanderings. And they're like a mirror image of each other. But in the 40 years that lay in between, this boy grew up to manhood. And whereas in the first episode of rebellion, the house of Levi is seen as standing forth for the principles of the truth, by the time we come to Numbers 25, we'll see that the house of Levi is represented now by just one man who embodies the very spirit of his tribe. Now, just have a look at those parallels then, in those two pages, you see? Now, you see how the record starts, 1F. You see, it all began with corruption of principle. That's where it always goes wrong, brothers and sisters and young people. That's why we've got to be guardians of divine principles. Because the moment principle is corrupted, that's where the danger begins, you see. That's where everything starts to unravel. And it unraveled in Exodus 32. And what happened was, we're told in Exodus 32 that the people were told, "These be thy gods." And they rose up and offered burnt offerings, and they brought peace offerings, and they corrupted the principles of divine worship. And that's exactly Numbers 25, when verse 2 says, "They called unto the sacrifices of their gods, and the people did eat and bow down to their gods." There was a general corruption of the divine principles of worship. And what the Bible tells us over and over again is that the moment you corrupt divine principle, you lead the way for the corruption of practice. The two follow. There's a sort of cause-effect relationship here. And so you see what happens in Exodus 32. It says, as a result of the corruption of principle, that the people rose up to play, and the people were made naked unto their shame among their enemies, and corruption of practice followed. And is not that the same thing in Numbers 25, when it says in verses 1 and 3 that Israel began to commit whoredoms with the daughters of Moab and joined himself unto Baal Peor? And those who believe that they can trifle with divine principles do so at their peril for the well-being of ecclesial life. And young people particularly are vulnerable to this because they don't always see divine principles. But every ecclesia must have its doorkeepers, you see, and its Phineases who become guardians of these principles and passionate for that which is right and true. And you see how the story happens. You see how it carries on. Because just as there were those who were prepared to corrupt principle and therefore corrupt practice, you see what it says at the end of that overhead, that the jealousy and anger of God was aroused as a result. Because he is a zealous God. And the word fierce wrath found in Exodus 32 verses 10 to 12 is the very same word translated fierce anger in Numbers 25. The jealousy of God is aroused when his principles are compromised. He's jealous for them. And he expects us to be zealous about them. And fortunately, on both occasions, there was someone prepared to manifest zeal. And so you see on the next overhead, 1G. Exodus 32 verse 26 says, "Who's on Yahweh's side? Unto me and all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together unto him. And that's Numbers 25, isn't it? When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose up from among the congregation. In Exodus, we're told, put every man his sword by his side and slay every man his brother. And the children of Levi did so. And in Numbers, we're told that Phinehas took a javelin in his hand. He went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust them both through. And so they were both prepared, the tribe in Exodus 32 and the man in Numbers 25, to repudiate absolutely that principle of corruption that had occurred and to be zealous for God's holiness. And they won the blessing and the approval of God as a result. And so Exodus 32 says that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day. And the blessing that the tribe of Levi received was the blessing of priesthood, that they might minister unto him, says Deuteronomy 10 verse 8. And of Phinehas, of course, as we're going to see in a later study, it says, behold, I give unto him, Phinehas, my covenant, and he shall have it in his seed, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood. And so you see, as those 40 years of the wilderness wanderings have rolled past now, brothers and sisters, and this young boy has grown up to manhood, he now becomes the hero of his tribe. No wonder Exodus 6 says, Levi to Phinehas. No need to go any further. Here is the highest spirit of the priestly tribe embodied in one outstanding individual. He's the exemplar of dedication in the house of Levi. All that was noble, all that was holy, all that was devout is summed up by this one man. You see, of his own house. Marvelous thing, brothers and sisters. Chapter 2. You see, time never dimmed the luster of his example, did it? How many years from the life of Phinehas to the time of Malachi? And the answer is 600 years, 700 years, 800 years. Hundreds of years later on, the supremacy of his example as the great man of the house of Levi, that example burned brightly still in the nation. And so Malachi says, doesn't he, in chapter 2 and verse 4, ye shall know that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with Levi, saith Yahweh of armies. My covenant was with him of life and peace. Of course, that's interesting, isn't it? Because do you know that it never ever says anywhere that God made a covenant of either life or peace with the house of Levi? Never says that anywhere, does it? But it does say in Numbers 25 that he made a covenant of peace with Phinehas. And that's where this phrase is drawn from. So when it says that I made a covenant of peace with Levi, it really was made through Phinehas, the greatest son of Levi of that house. And you notice the singular terms all the way through these verses. You see, he's talking about a tribe, isn't he? The tribe of Levi. And yet notice the language. My covenant was with him of life and peace, and I gave them to him for the fear wherewith he feared me and was afraid before my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, not their mouth, not them, his. And although the whole tribe of Levi is being called upon in Malachi as an outstanding example of faithfulness, within that tribe there was one man whose example shined above the rest. And so the terminology here, we believe, is couched in the singular, because I think the prophet had in mind Phinehas himself at the end of it all. In fact, it says in verse 6 that he had turned many away from iniquity, which could, of course, be the action of the tribe in Exodus 32, but could just as equally be the action of Phinehas in Numbers 25 when he stopped the plague. You know the word iniquity that's found there in Malachi 2 verse 6, he had turned many away from iniquity. It's the very word that Phinehas himself uses in the book of Joshua, where he refers to this matter in Joshua 22, and he says, he calls this the iniquity of Peor. That's in Joshua 22 verse 17, same word. He did turn many away from iniquity. And I think that at least Phinehas is
is in the mind of the prophet here as the great hero of his tribe. You notice this also, verse 6, the law of truth was in his mouth, iniquity was not found in his lips. Verse 17, the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth. Why this emphasis in Malachi on the law and the truth coming out of the mouth of Levi? And the answer is, I think you see, that Phinehas means the mouth of brass. Now the question is, of course, why do you think he's called the mouth of brass? Well, that's homework for this afternoon. And we shall come back to that matter, shall we, in a later study. Why would he be called the mouth of brass? But why then does Malachi say you should go to the priest and seek the law at his mouth? Oh yes, I think that Malachi has Phinehas in mind in terms of the great example that he upholds here. And what's the reason why Malachi introduces that example? Because he's dealing at a time when the whole nation had been corrupting divine principle, and he introduces Phinehas as the very antithesis of that spirit of corruption. He says, look, he was a man who never corrupted divine principle. He was a man who always stood for that which was right and true in his life and as far as he could affect in the lives of others. Hearken to him. Watch him. Follow him is the exhortation of Malachi. He was a great man, brothers and sisters. He became the giant of his tribe. From the very moment he steps into the divine record, he's going to be a man of destiny, you see. See, you think about that. You see, Exodus 6, remember, is the genealogy of Moses and Aaron, doesn't it? And yet the record focuses on Levi to Phinehas in a genealogy that really isn't about him. He's there as a man of significance right from the start. Now, what we'd like to do in terms of looking at the reason why he rose to this time of greatness is I'd like now to have a look at what we think was the turning point in the life of Phinehas that led him to become the man he was. So yes, he became a great man. Now the question is, the burning question is, what brought him to that greatness? What was it? And there are many of us out there in life who maybe look back on our lives and we think about some dramatic episode that's affected us, some incident that has touched us, some event that has affected us for the good of the truth. Well, I think there was a great turning point in the life of Phinehas, you see. And I'd like to show that to you in Leviticus chapter 10. I think this was where his life was changed. Perhaps changed isn't quite the right word, because I don't think necessarily it needed changing at all, but I think this was the great moment in his life that he would look back on as the greatest thing that affected him for the principles that he would uphold for the rest of his life. And we take up the record in Leviticus chapter 10, which is of course the story of the death of Nadab and Abihu. We're not going to deal with the whole chapter, just a few pertinent verses right at the beginning. But we're going to start the story by reading together. Well, let's start from verse 23, shall we, of Leviticus 9. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of the congregation and came out and blessed the people. And the glory of Yahweh appeared unto all the people. And there came a fire out from before Yahweh and consumed upon the altar the burnt offering and the fat, which when all the people saw, they shouted and fell on their faces. And. Oh, it's an important word, and, isn't it? And Nadab and Abihu. You see, I think what we're being told in Leviticus 10 and verse 1, you see, by the word and, that the episode of the strange fire of Nadab and Abihu occurred at the very height of the consecration ceremony of the Aaronic priesthood, at the very climax of that ceremony. And in came these two men
with strange fire at the very moment when their father was being inducted into the priesthood after the order of Aaron. Now come back to Exodus 24 and have a look at this. This is important. Exodus chapter 24 says this, because you see, we've come across Nadab and Abihu once before. And we're told this in verse 1. You see the connection here with Leviticus 10. In Exodus 24, in verse 1, it says, "He said unto Moses, Come up unto Yahweh, thou and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel." Now, look at these words. "And worship ye afar off, and Moses alone shall come near Yahweh, but they shall not come nigh." Now, you see what the divine record said is that there was a specific exemption so that Moses could draw near to God, but none other, not even Aaron. And now, what have we seen in Leviticus chapter 9 and verse 23 at the consecration ceremony of the Aaronic order? We see in verse 23 it says, "And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of the congregation and came out." So that privilege of approaching to God that was reserved firstly for Moses alone in Exodus 24 has now been extended to embrace Aaron the high priest. So what do you think Nadab and Abihu thought in Leviticus chapter 10 and verse 1? They have now seen Aaron their father go near. Why should not they themselves also be prominent in the worship and draw near to God? And so they take every man or either man his censer and put fire therein and put incense thereon and offered strange fire. You see, what I think they did, brothers and sisters, I think that they walked towards the tabernacle with every intention of entering in to offer incense to God personally. If Moses can do it and Aaron can do it, why cannot we be involved as well? You know, there's an ancient rabbinical teaching that says this of these two men. The old rabbinical writers say that the reason why Nadab and Abihu never married is because they could not find a woman in Israel worthy of marriage to them. They were men of pride. And here is their pride, you see. They thought they had every right to draw near to God. And if we were to ask the question, by the way, in verse 1, what do you think strange fire is? I suppose the simplest answer is that which God has commanded not, as it says at the end of the verse. Do you know what the key word is in Leviticus 8 and 9? The key word in Leviticus 8 and 9 is they did as Yahweh had commanded. They did as Yahweh has commanded. They did as Yahweh had commanded. All the way through those two chapters. And finally we come to chapter 10, verse 1. He commanded them not. That's what strange fire is. That which God has not asked for. Neither had Aaron asked for it. Neither had Moses asked for it. And the whole point of this episode is that they simply acted independently of anybody else. They did what they wished to do. And I believe that the spirit of their error was in that presumptuous spirit of arrogance whereby they promoted themselves and were prepared to compromise divine principle in so doing. What was the strange fire? Could have been any one of what was the problem, if you like, in the offering of this strange fire in Leviticus 10, verse 1? It could have been several different things. I can think of at least four. Here they are. Firstly, the problem may have been because they were drunk. We're told that, aren't we? The clue there is verse 8, that immediately after the episode, Yahweh spake unto Aaron, saying, "Do not drink wine nor strong drink, thou nor thy sons with thee, when ye go into the tabernacle of the congregation, lest ye die, that ye may put difference between holy and unholy." And as has been rightly said, why this sudden injunction about wine drinking? and the dangers of drunkenness hard on the heels of the death of these two boys, unless that's what the problem was. In other words, brothers and sisters, not all the drink offerings had been poured out at the base of the altar. But if that was true, and it may be true, they're not judged for drunkenness in this chapter, are they? Even if that had been a problem. The second thing is, it may have been strange fire that was not acceptable because the fire used was not taken from the coals of the altar, which in chapter 9, verse 24, had been lit by the very fire of Yahweh himself. Maybe that was the reason, that they hadn't used coals from the altar in the prescribed way. A third possibility is that it was using an incense that was not properly prepared according to the instructions of Exodus chapter 30 and verses 34 to 38. And all of those things may be true, but you see, I think that the greatest problem here, the real thing that caused this judgment to come upon these boys, was that they intended to draw near to God and felt they had every right to do so. And they were prepared to usurp the role of others, including their father, in asserting their own preeminence. Do you know that immediately after this episode, the record of the Day of Atonement is given? And in Leviticus 16 and verses 12 and 13, we're told this, and this is true, isn't it? Immediately after this episode, is that the law prescribed that from now on, there would only ever be one man who would put incense in a censer and bring it before God. There would only ever be one man allowed to do that, and on one day, and in one place. And it wouldn't be them, it wouldn't be the sons, it wouldn't be the boys, it would be the high priest alone. That law in Leviticus 16 follows immediately after this episode in Leviticus 10. I think they were presumptuous, these two boys. And they were prepared to set aside divine principles in order to advance themselves. And so verse 2 says, there went out fire from Yahweh and devoured them, and they died before Yahweh. They died before Yahweh. I think they were heading into the sanctuary at the time. And the great tragedy of this is that the same fire that flashed divine approval in chapter 9 and verse 24 now flashes out divine judgment in chapter 10 and verse 2. We cannot trifle, brothers and sisters, with divine principles. And so Moses said in verse 3, Moses said unto Aaron, this is that Yahweh spake, saying, I will be sanctified in them that come nigh me, and before all the people I will be glorified. And Aaron held his peace. Now, there is no place in the law, no specific passage in the law, that Moses appears to be referring to, apart from a general principle. We're told in Exodus 19 and verse 22. We're told in Exodus 29 and verse 44 that God demanded absolute holiness in those that approached him. And the evidence of the devouring fire here was proof that he had upheld that requirement, and he had rejected those who had corrupted his principles. We're going to come back to the significance of this phrase, I will be sanctified in them that come nigh me. We'll come back to that at the end of this study, God willing. And at the end of the verse it says, and Aaron held his peace. Oh, what a phrase is that, brothers and sisters. Aaron held his peace. Actually, the word peace here means to be silent or dumb. And I think that's the point, you see. I think that he was absolutely struck dumb with bewilderment, with shock, with grief, with fear. He didn't know what to do. He didn't dare dispute the divine sentence, but he'd be absolutely staggered as to the speed and the severity of that sentence. What could Aaron do but remain speechless that day in humble acceptance of the divine judgment? How do you think Aaron felt that day as he looked upon the dead bodies of his two oldest boys, including the first high priest elect, Nadab? And they're dead in front of him.
How do you think Moses, how do you think Aaron would have felt? What could he say? And verse 4 says, Moses called Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Uzziel, the uncle of Aaron, and said unto them, come near and carry your brethren from before the sanctuary out of the camp. Actually, if you go to your overheads, you'll see a genealogy on overhead 1C. A genealogy of Phinehas. And you see Mishael and Elzaphan there. On the right-hand side, three, four generations down, they are the sons of Uzziel. And Uzziel, in turn, was the uncle of Aaron on the left-hand side. And, of course, the question is raised, why these two? Why were they chosen to take the bodies out? And the only suggestion I've heard is that they were the nearest of kin within the tribe who had not been consecrated that day. Because, of course, no priest who had been consecrated on that day for the service of inauguration could come near a dead body because they would, of course, be defiled. And so the suggestion has been made that perhaps these two, Mishael and Elzaphan, were the nearest of the family that could, as near kinsmen, initiate the burial procedures. And so the record says, to these two men, Moses says, come near and carry your brethren from before the sanctuary out of the camp. They were on their way inside, brothers and sisters. They intended to draw near, but they were not sanctified, and God would not accept them. And so verse 5 says, so they went near, and they carried them in their coats out of the camp. And herein lies an interesting puzzle, doesn't it? Because you see verse 2, how then did the fire devour them if they were carried out in their coats in verse 5? And I think the fire was a flash of lightning. I think the fire was the divine bolt from heaven that charred the body but left the clothing intact. And you know what's significant about the coats, verse 5, is they're not ordinary coats, are they? They are the special coats of the priests. The word is keteneth, and it's the same word found in Exodus 28, verses 40 and 41, and Exodus 40, verses 14 and 15, of the linen garments associated with the protocol of worship that the priests must conform to. These were the very linen garments that the priests must wear in order to minister before God. They were taken out in those coats, charred bodies within, white linen garment without. And that linen coat was the outward sign of a holiness that should have been matched by an inward purity. But it wasn't there, brothers and sisters, was it? It wasn't there in Nadab and Abihu. In the words of the Lord, these charred bodies testified to the fact that they had never developed that inward purity of thought that God demands of those who would approach to him. And so in the Lord's words, they were like whited sepulchres on the outside, but within they were full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. And two charred bodies were taken out of the camp in their linen garments. And verse 6 says, Moses said unto Aaron and unto Eleazar and unto Ithamar his sons, uncover not your heads, neither rend your clothes, lest ye die, and lest wrath come upon all the people. And the uncovering of the head and the rending of the clothes here, of course, the disheveled hair and the torn garments are the classic symbols of mourning. So you see, what I think verse 6 is telling us is that all manifestations of personal grief were forbidden. Even in a time of catastrophe here, the priests must set an example of strict obedience and unswerving faithfulness
to divine standards. All natural feelings of family loss were to be set aside. They had to uphold the righteousness and the holiness of God. There had to be no grief and no tears. Do you know why? Because either grief or tears could imply either sympathy for the sin or disagreement with the sentence. And as Yahweh's representatives, they could not be seen to do that. They had to uphold God's holiness absolutely. Of course, the people could lament, and they're encouraged to. At the end of verse 6, let your brethren, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning which Yahweh hath kindled. And so the people, on the other hand, are permitted to lament over the tragedy and to ponder the lessons of that day as to why this had occurred. And verse 7 says, ye shall not go out from the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, lest ye die, for the anointing oil of Yahweh is upon you, and they did according to the word of Moses. You know what verse 7 is telling us, brothers and sisters? Just stop and think about this. You know what verse 7 is telling us? It's telling us that Aaron was not allowed to attend the funeral of his own son. He never saw them again. The last moment that he ever saw them, brothers and sisters, was the charred bodies before the tabernacle. Instead, the burden lay upon him of completing the whole of those activities of the day without so much as a tear. Can you imagine the strain on that man that day? And you see how heavy it laid upon them? Verse 6, not only were they not to do these things, but it says, you must not show grief lest ye die, and lest wrath come upon all the congregation. The fate of the nation that day lay upon the shoulders of Aaron to complete his ministrations amidst his own personal tragedy. And he was left with his remaining sons to complete the ministrations as a result of Nadab and Abihu's folly in promoting themselves. What a day that was in the history of the tribe of Levi. And what a day that was, brothers and sisters, because I tell you this, and young people, now think about this. On that day, the life of Phinehas was forever changed. Because on that day, from being simply the offspring of the third son, he now became the son of the high priest elect. And he now stood in the direct line of the high priesthood himself from that day. Did he not? Now you imagine Eliezer bringing up that boy. You imagine Eliezer bringing up Phinehas after the tragedy of this chapter and saying to his son, drumming into his son this lesson, son, the only reason that you stand in the line of the priesthood and I your father is because your uncle's corrupted divine principle. Don't you ever, ever, ever do that in your life. If ever there was a boy that knew that principle, it would be drummed into this lad, would it not? That the only reason he stood in that new position of responsibility was because principle, divine principle, had been terribly corrupted, and that if he wished to preserve the responsibilities of his tribe and of his office, there was an absolute necessity for strict adherence to divine standards. Was there ever a boy that didn't understand that? I think that was the turning point of his life, that episode, and I'll prove it to you in a minute, lest you think that's mere assertion. Now, do you know that I think within less than 2 years, another episode occurred that was virtually copybook for this one. In the same tribe, exactly the same problems. Now, what was that? Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Numbers 16. Let's just have a look at that, shall we? By the way, before you go, Leviticus 10, in the margin, D, Numbers 16, G, Numbers 16, P, Numbers 16, S, Numbers 16. You'll find that the record of Korah, Dathan and Abiram is all the way through Leviticus 10. Now, they're almost mirror images, these two stories. Now, just have a look at this, you see. We won't go through the whole record. We'll just pick up one or two highlights. But it's exactly the same, you see. In principle, it is exactly the same. Now, Numbers 16, verse 1, Korah the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. So here he is. Here's the leader of this particular tragedy on this occasion. Of course, he says in verse 3, ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and Yahweh is among... He's a great politician, Korah, wasn't he? Wonderful politician, this man. All the congregation is holy, every one of them. But is that what he really believed? And is that what Korah really wanted? Did he want holiness for all the congregation? No, he didn't want that at all, did he? And Moses, of course, saw straight through him. And so he says in the same chapter in verse 10, Moses puts his finger right on the pulse immediately, doesn't he? He says to Korah, verse 10, he's brought thee near to him, and all thy brethren, the sons of Levi, with thee, and seek ye the priesthood also. You see, here is the same arrogant, presumptuous spirit of Nadab and Abihu manifested in Korah, prepared to set aside divine principle for the advancing of their own personal claims and their own personal purposes. You know how dangerous this rebellion became? It says, verse 18, they took every man his censer and put fire in them and laid incense. Oh, they took every man his censer and put fire in them. Where have we heard all that before? He laid incense thereon, and they stood in the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And it says that Moses fell on his face, verse 22, and they said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and wilt thou be wroth with all the congregation? And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the congregation, saying, get you up from about the tabernacle of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Did you notice, brothers and sisters, or have you noticed, that the tabernacle of Korah in verse 24 is not the same word as the tents of these wicked men in verse 26, nor the tabernacle of Korah in verse 27 is the same as the tents in which they lived later on in the verse. I think that what the word tabernacle means in Numbers 16 is that there was already a rival tent of worship established, and a priesthood, and a high priest ready to stand in the breach and to take over the reins of priestly responsibility. That's how far this rebellion had come. And now, come and have a look at the overheads again, and you'll see this in 1E on the second side. That it's called Twin Tragedies in the House of Levi, because, you see, I think that Phinehas lived through both these episodes at a relatively young age. And you see, they both have the same lessons. In both occasions, Leviticus 10 and Numbers 16, there is the same presumptuous spirit that asserts self and is quite prepared to corrupt divine principle. In Leviticus 10 and Numbers 16, there is the same swift rejection by God in the flashing fire of his jealous anger and his consuming judgment. In Leviticus 10 and Numbers 16, there's the same standard of absolute holiness that is demanded of those who draw near to God. Just have a look at that in verse 5 of Numbers 16. It says, even tomorrow Yahweh will show who are his, and as Rodahim says, is, and who is the Holy One, and will cause him to come near unto himself. You see, this is exactly the same as Leviticus 10. I will be sanctified in them that come near me. There was a standard of holiness that God expected. And here's the last lesson. Verse 6 of Leviticus 10 and Numbers 16, verse 22, the same dreadful lesson of how the sin and the folly of the few can bring wrath upon the many. And you see, the one involved the death of his uncles, and the other involved the death of his great-uncle, and Phinehas was to learn from first-hand experiences in his own tribe the fatal consequences of corruption of divine principle. You see, I think that he was greatly touched by those episodes. They were seared into his memory. From that time forth, he would be Yahweh's man. He would be a champion for holiness and the enemy of corruption. He knew what the example of good or evil could be upon others. And he knew that of all those in Israel, the greatest example was the high priest, and the second greatest example was the high priest elect. And I think that from that time forth, Phinehas began preparing for his role, and he was absolutely determined that in his lifetime and during his priesthood, he would adhere to the very highest standard of personal holiness. And I think that the motto of Phinehas's life was Leviticus 10 verse 3, I will be sanctified in them that come near me. Now, do you want to know how we know that those two episodes were the turning point in his life? Well, I'll show you. Now come back to Leviticus 10. In Leviticus 10, verse 6, Moses said unto Aaron and unto Eleazar and unto Ithamar his sons, uncover not your heads, neither rend your clothes, lest ye die, and lest. Now, I want you to listen to this phrase. Lest wrath, kotzaf, that's the Hebrew word, come upon all the congregation, Edah. This example of corruption, which began with one, had the consequences or the ability to extend out to implicate others in the tragedy of divine judgment that would fall, lest wrath, kotzaf, come upon all the congregation, Edah. Do you want to see the second time that phrase is ever found in the Bible? Why? It's Numbers 16. Numbers 16, verse 22. And they fell upon their faces, and they said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and wilt thou be wroth, kotzaf, with all the congregation, Edah? Same thing, you see, isn't it? Same words. Now, here's the really interesting thing, you see, that those two words are only found together in one other place in the Bible. And that's in Joshua chapter 22. Only found three times together, you see, and here's the third occasion. Now, what's Joshua 22 about? Well, that's another study, really, but it's going to come up later on. But we're told that, verse 13, the children of Israel sent unto the children of Reuben, and they actually sent Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, says verse 13. So that when it says in verse 15, they came to the children of Reuben, and they spake with them, saying, thus saith the whole congregation, that the person who really spoke in verse 16 was the spokesman for the delegation. And I'm going to show you, God willing, in the study that follows on this chapter, that I think the spokesman was clearly Phinehas, and that Phinehas was therefore speaking on the occasion of this speech from verse 16 onwards. And it's Phinehas, therefore, that's speaking, you see. And in verse 18 he says that ye must turn away this day from following Yahweh, and it will be, seeing ye rebel today against Yahweh, that tomorrow he will be wroth, kotzaf, with the whole congregation, Edah. that's the only other place in the Bible that those two words are found together, and one remarkably similar, almost identical, which is in this same chapter and verse 20, and it's also Phineas speaking. Did not Achan the son of Zerah commit a trespass in the accursed thing, and wrath, Ketzaph, fell on all the congregation, Edah? You see, I think Phineas is quoting the other two occasions. I think he was greatly affected by those two episodes of tragedy in his own tribe. He never forgot them. I think they were the turning point in his life. Let's just summarise, brothers and sisters, because I see that our time has certainly well and truly gone. You see, when God says, I will be sanctified in them that draw nigh me, this is not simply a commandment that God says. It's actually the declaration, I believe, of an absolute truth. Now just listen to this in conclusion. You see, when God says, I will be sanctified in those that draw nigh me, I think what he's saying is that those who are not sanctified cannot draw nigh to him. Do you know what I mean? You see, what I'm saying is, they cannot find God, those that are not sanctified. They cannot feel his power. They cannot understand his mind. They cannot know his character. Those who are not sanctified will never find God. They cannot, in an absolute sense, draw near to him. And neither can we, brothers and sisters and young people, neither can we if we're not sanctified. Now the fact is, we live in a world of shocking unholiness. The books of the world, the magazines of the world, the music of the world, the movies of the world, the dress of the world, the entertainment of the world, the speech of the world, the habits of the world, the pleasures of the world, bombard us daily with unholy words, unholy sounds, unholy sights, and unholy thoughts. And we cannot draw near to God if we are unholy. And our very work, you see, our very role as priests is under attack day by day from the world in which we live. We find that we cannot draw near to him. What moments of time in your life, brothers and sisters, or young people, have you ever felt truly near to God? That you've actually come into his presence? Near him. Isn't it when you've been washed with divine principles, mind and heart finally made pure from all the other distracting and impure influences about us? It's the only way, brothers and sisters, how precious those moments are and how infrequent they are. We've got to mount a counterattack, don't we? We've got to be zealous for God's holiness in our lives so that we can draw near to him. That was Phineas's watchword. He was prepared to devote the rest of his life to being sanctified so that he could draw near to the God whom he worshipped, and that should be our spirit as well. Our final overhead says, in summary, 1H, zeal and the virtue of holiness. Fellowship with God is based upon the principle of personal holiness. God is jealous of his principles, and corruption of them will ultimately have fatal consequences. Holiness is that which is clean and pure from God's perspective, and jealousy for this standard is true zeal. Conversely, there must be an equal abhorrence of that which is not pure. Phineas learned of the enormous influence one can have upon others for good or evil. He determined in his own life to aspire to the very highest of standards. He would be a champion of holiness and the enemy of corruption, a course of life he would pursue with zeal and passion. His fame came
from the manifestation of the Spirit. And that Spirit, brothers and sisters, is the one that we must find also. If in our own day and in our own ungodly age, we would draw near to God.
We'd like to thank our brother Roger, brethren and sisters, because he has reminded us very strongly that to honour Yahweh is to honour the principles of his arrangements. And that if there are no precepts about what we want to do in his word, we ought to refrain from it, because we have not been commanded to do it. And that we are to have no sympathy with sin, but to cause to grow in our minds a sensitivity to righteousness. Brethren and sisters, we did omit at the beginning of our meeting to mention the extent of the travel that some of our members here at the camp have undertaken to be with us, because we are reminded from up here that there are some people here from Swansea in Wales. There is one person from Manchester in England, and there are other people here who have come from Toronto in Canada. And of course, we do want to wish everybody a very happy and a spiritually growing time here at the camp, because our objective is that we might grow in accordance with those principles of the word that we are being instructed upon. We will ask our secretary, Brother John Lund, to come forward and give the announcements after the organist has concluded her voluntary. But first of all, through the singing of hymn number 5, and then with prayer, we will conclude our first study together.